Hi, everyone. This is Deborah Rue, and you're listening to Human Potential at Work or watching us live on Facebook. Happy holidays, everyone. I am the CEO of Rue Global, and we are market influencers and brand ambassadors for the community of people with disabilities and the aging market. Today, my guest is somebody that I've never met. There's a lot of people I haven't met in person, but I actually found his work on Twitter, and I started following his work, and I was very impressed. And I've listened to some of his shows, and I thought, boy, I got to have him on my show so that I can introduce you to him, because I think a lot of you are going to want to find out more about his show and start following him, because he's a really, really powerful voice. So Al Levin, welcome to the program.
I'm really excited to be here. Thank you for the invite, Deborah. I've been looking forward to this for quite some time.
Yeah, I really appreciate your flexibility. I know, you know, you have all these other things in your life and your own show. And so I appreciate you fitting us in. But I think what you talk about on your show, especially from the perspective, from a male perspective, as opposed to all of us, I think is very interesting. So will you tell the audience a little bit about who you are, Al, and then also tell us more about your show?
Sure. So I am actually an assistant principal in St. Paul Public Schools. So I work in a large urban school district. And in 2010 and in 2013, I had two major bouts of depression that I went through. And the first one I was able to manage through with some medication and some talk therapy. And the second one, you know, my brother, who's a huge supporter of mine and really helpful, he's a family doctor, unfortunately lives in England, but he was a super huge help. He reminds me that first depression was really quite serious, although I always say it really, the second one paled in comparison and really made the first one feel like a walk through the park. And the second one became so extreme that I ended up leaving my job as an administrator in the school system for 3 weeks and checked myself into a partial hospitalization program. Wow. And then just personally, I have a family with four kids. Wow. I have a 12-year-old, a 10-year-old, and two 7-year-olds. Wow. So a busy household, a super helpful and understanding wife who does let me spend time on my podcast. And I know you had asked about that as well. My podcast is The Depression Files, and it consists of entirely interviews with men who have been through depression. And it's been going just over a year strong. I publish every other week, every other Sunday. And I have just learned so much from the men I interview. And so it's been really inspirational for me and a learning journey. It's been therapeutic. And that's my passion, really. My boss at work knows that's my true passion. My passion is mental health advocacy. And I would like to mention, it's really pretty interesting that you are interviewing me. It's two or three days after new data just came out. And in Minnesota in particular, in the past 2 years, just in a 2-year period, male suicides in the past 2 years in the Twin City metro area, 7-county area, has increased by 18%.
Wow.
It's huge. It's huge. And really
and scary. Yeah. Very scary.
And the, you know, part of what got me compelled to share my story and to start my advocacy work is the data. And the data gets worse each year. And the most recent 2017 data came out through the CDC. And every 11.1 minutes, there's a death by suicide in the United States. And in that 11.1 minute is our 25 attempts. So that equates to an attempt in the U.S., an attempt less than every 28 seconds. So just in this brief introduction, imagine in the United States how many people who have attempted to take their lives. It's really scary, and I think it needs to be a focus of the attention of many more people, and we need to do a much better job than what we're doing as a society.
I agree. And I talk about this topic a lot because on my show, we're talking about human potential at work. So a play on words, but you know, what does it mean to be human and what is our potential and who are we? And are we less because we're depressed or because we have Down syndrome or something else? So I talk about that a lot, but I also, as you know, depression is a part of my life, and it is something I've struggled with my entire life, or as long as I could remember. And it is really horrific at times, but at the same time, there's also been so many gifts associated with it. I think it's made me more empathetic. It's made me be a little bit more careful with my life and to think about things. And my producer, Doug Foresto, he just started a show called Mind Talk, and he actually wants to have you on that show as well. And we just did his first episode. He's a long time host. Yeah, he's been a host of multiple programs and very, very popular. And his work can be found on iTunes and other channels. But we talked about, I loved the title he came up with, holidays are the most wonderful time of the year, or are they? And so I think, a lot of people struggle with it. But one thing that I actually ask you this on Twitter, I think it is so interesting that you're looking at it from the perspective of the male, because I think even though as society, we love to trash the males and certainly the Caucasian males in our society, they are, you know, pretty much the Caucasian males. And I have a son that's a Caucasian male and a husband, but, you know, they're pretty much at... A lot of them are doing things that aren't good for our society. So I think it's interesting that I think sometimes it's so much harder for males in our society. And dealing with something like depression, well, if you're a real man, Al, you're not going to be depressed. So how do you take all of the themes that we put upon males and drill it down into this topic? I'm fascinated by your work.
Yeah. So for me, really, I believe strongly that the more we talk about mental illness, the more we share our stories, the more we chip away at the stigma. And there is a huge stigma about exactly what you're talking about. People see it as a weakness. People don't understand it. People question or raise an eyebrow if you talk about medication and mental illness, yet nobody raises an eyebrow if you're taking insulin or if you're taking chemotherapy. That's just expected. And I have intentionally sought out certain men from certain areas that I want to interview who particularly fight that stigma. So I think you mentioned Caucasian men, right? I think black males have a struggle with it. And I just happen to be in a school district that I love. St. Paul Public Schools has done a lot of racial equity work, so it's always high on my radar. But I know in a 3-week partial hospitalization program I was in, where people are entering and exiting the program on a regular basis, so you're always seeing new faces. I saw one black man in my 3 weeks, and he lasted 2 days there, and then he left. And that does not speak to the low incidence of depression in black men. It speaks to the fact that it's such a stigma. I also, even though I've been mentally healthy since 2013, I still attend a men's support group for depression and anxiety every other week. And they get together, all of these groups, for a huge breakfast monthly. And again, not a person of color there.
Wow.
So I think those populations have to really be more open to talking about depression. In addition to that, of course, we have our military vets who see a high incidence of suicide. They also are in a machismo position, right? You got to be tough. You're holding the weapon policemen, EMTs, first responders and firemen who are, seeing trauma before their very eyes on a regular basis. And how does that impact their mental health? And really, so I've got some of those men on my shows and I'm always looking for more. And it really is a challenge. Men don't like to talk about emotions. Men like to bury it and be the tough guy and pull yourself up by the bootstraps. That's the message many boys get at a young age. Quit crying, right?
Right. Well, be a man. Be a man. Yeah, I agree. Exactly. I agree. And I am blessed to be a mother of a male child and a daughter as well. And I tried really hard not to put that stuff on my son. And I will say, even though he might not appreciate it, but I know that my son, like myself, because we know that these things run in families. Yeah. My mother had borderline personality disorder, and she passed away the last day of the year, but she, we are pretty confident she hurried that death along, and I won't go down that path, but it's interesting because my son also struggles with depression and anxiety. We've talked about it a lot, and I tried never to put some of those things on him that I saw others doing, but boy, I saw situations where the males were just really struggling under the pressures. We didn't seem to be putting the females under some of the same pressures. And of course, you know, we have this wonderful society that's full of opportunities for things because so many things are broken, and that's how we evolve and blah, blah, blah. But it really is important for us to be addressing these mental health issues.
Yeah, it's critical. And yes. I'm glad you mentioned gender, because that was a group that I missed and needs to be addressed too. The LGBTQ community yes. sees a high rate of suicide and depression.
Right.
And you know, there are many more that I probably missed that listeners might be like, hey, you forgot about this one, Al, and this one, because there are so many groups. And it's not to say that depression doesn't hit women. Women get hit hard too. I just chose to focus on men. It's who I can relate to. It's like I mentioned, the data supports more women attempt suicide, more men complete suicide.
Yes, and, I've heard that. So, women are more efficient at committing suicide than women.
Yeah, they really very sad. It's really the means they choose that makes it.
Yeah, I have a woman that I did not know, but a really, really dear friend of mine was a friend of hers, and the woman was 66 years old. She was caring for her aging mother. She had three adult children. She had three grandchildren. She was an artist. She had a beautiful life, and she chose to hang herself. And as somebody that's walked the path of depression, I understand how dark it gets. And, you know, being around it my whole life, I think we're all around it. Maybe we just don't sometimes realize we're surrounded by it. And a lot of us are putting on the brave faces so we don't look weak. But it's a serious, serious issue. And the devastation that was left by this poor woman that was obviously in trouble. So everybody's saying, what could I have done? What could I have done? What could I have done?
Right.
And all the other emotions that people walk, it, like you said, Al, I can't think of anything that's more important. And I just want to say this. I don't know this. I need to actually investigate this. But I know the CDC this year came out with a number saying that 1 in 4 American adults have disabilities, identify having disabilities. And I need to dig into those numbers because I know mental health is part of the Americans with Disabilities Act. So I believe that the numbers are higher than that.
Yeah. And so with mental illness, they do say 1 in 4 to 1 in 5 people are living with a mental illness at any point in the given year. And if you think it's 1 in 4 or 1 in 5, if it's not somebody sitting next to you, they're probably connected pretty closely with somebody who has a mental illness.
Yes, and it is confusing. And we have demonized the drugs too. And I, once again, as somebody that battles it myself, I have at times been on medication, and sometimes it's been helpful, sometimes not. I have been in therapy. I've tried to get therapy, you know, for my children who also have this, and we haven't had a lot of luck. And that's once again something that Doug Forrest, as a licensed therapist, is going to talk about on his show. But okay, so I'm a man, and I know I'm depressed. I'm having these thoughts. I need to do something. I think a lot of people don't even know where to turn, Al, which is why your program is so important in your walk. Where do they go, Al? It's the holidays. I'm supposed to be happy.
Yeah, so that's a a great question. And one thing I'd like to point out before answering that is I think sometimes men don't even recognize they're having depression and depressive systems, you know, or they might brush it off as, oh, I'm just sad and everybody gets sad. But there is a clinical definition, and I'm not going to go through all of the points of that definition. But, you know, if you are concerned or if somebody else is concerned about you, then it's time, I would recommend starting with a family doctor. You know, start with a family doctor or the GP and get in and let them know about your symptoms. Many times a general practice doctor, a family doctor who, I want to be cautious because my brother, who's a family doctor, thinks once in a while I trash them, and I really, really don't mean to. And as you can see, it's the first step, I would say. I do, and oftentimes they will go through a checklist with you and see if you meet the criteria for depression. And they should and probably would investigate with you the option of a medication. They would probably recommend talk therapy and hopefully have some recommendations for you. And that's typically a first starting point. I do think, and this is, and I think my brother would agree with me, if it gets to be a complicated situation or there needs to be change in medications, then it might be time to see a psychiatrist who really works closely with those medications. But I think those are first steps, and to know that the GP may not recommend medication, and that doesn't have to be the first step. One thing I always say about the medication is utilize it if it's needed, and it's not for everybody, but please don't judge people. These are difficult decisions. And I really get frustrated when I'm out on Twitter and I hear people berating medication or berating somebody for relying on it.
Because they're so weak. Hey, yeah, Al, let me ask you a question.
Sure.
And excuse me for interrupting you, but I just know this is a problem. So I know, including myself, I agree with you going to, you know, your GP or your primary physician. But a lot of us are really worried about having, you know, a medical doctor put depression or any other mental health on our medical records. We're really scared about that.
So I understand that, and I think that is part of the stigma. You know, there is a whole topic we could get into about discrimination in the workplace.
Yes.
And I believe that if we can do away with the stigma, that it's tightly aligned with the discrimination. If we got rid of the stigma and all the fears and concerns we have, then we can attack this discrimination of people having to worry. And they shouldn't have to worry in the workplace. The workplace should be a supportive place. I do want to mention, too, if there is a fear of a doctor, you know, you can probably speak with the doctor about the confidentiality pieces. I told my doctor, what do I do? You're like, I go to my dentist and they ask me if I'm on medication. Do I have to tell them? And you know, I won't mention my doctor's name, but he said, no, you know what? A dentist probably doesn't need to know if you're on medication for depression. But I do believe some of that is the shame, right? Some of it, us from wanting people to know is more about the shame. Some of the discrimination is real. And some of it is just this shame we have to get past too, of not wanting to say I'm on medication because you do feel weak or you may get judged. And I do want to mention, you know, another fantastic resource for those listeners in the United States, at least, is NAMI, N-A-M-I, National Alliance on Mental Illness. If you go to NAMI.org, they have many affiliates in many states, and they don't offer direct service for therapy, but what they do offer is family classes for people who are struggling with a mental illness. They offer many different types of support groups. They offer courses for those who are struggling with a mental illness or their family members. So they also are a great liaison who can direct you to some great resources. So I always feel like they're a good place to give a call to as well, to check in about support groups and such. And I'm a huge believer in support groups as well.
I agree. I find that just knowing, just having somebody talk to you about the issues. And I remember going to my general practitioner, and she also, my mother had relocated from Florida to Virginia to be close to me so I could help her. And my doctor was seeing my mother, and so she knew how much my mother was struggling with mental health. And my doctor, I went in to just see her, and my doctor said, "Are you okay? I know what you're dealing with. Are you okay?" And I said, "Oh, I'm fine. I'm fine. I'm making it. I'm doing mindfulness. I'm doing my meditation. I'm blah, 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 blah." She's like, "Okay, I hear you." She said, "I've met your mother though. And I understand you're walking things, you know, with my beautiful husband with his dementia attacking at his brain and my daughter with Down syndrome that got very, very ill, blah, blah, blah." She said, "And you shouldn't have to work so hard just to make it, Deborah. You shouldn't have to work so hard just to make it. We actually have medication that can help you." But and then there's also new medication. I know that CBD is, part of the cannabis plant it's showing very promising things for depression, and it's legal in all of the United States. You know, it's not the THC that's causes you to get high, but the CBD has got some real wonderful properties, and St. John's Wort. There's other things. There's other arsenals that our medical professionals can work with us to help us do. So what about things like that? Some of the things that are popping up. It seems like we're learning so much about our brains right now.
Yeah, there is a lot. it seems like a lot of... You know, it's really complicated. I think our medication, yes. It's amazing that to me that a medication takes so long to kick in for depression, right? We're yes. talking about really vulnerable people who may be at a point of taking their lives, and it can take so long for a medication to kick in fully to be at a therapeutic level, 4 to 6 weeks, some say 6 to 8 weeks. And right. and then to figure out, wait a minute, this medication isn't working. Right. And then to change the medication, maybe in the same group of an SSRI or an SRNI, if I got that right, and to change groups or not, right? So it's so complex. And so and a lot of pharmaceuticals, from what I've read, aren't even looking at new medications, but there is the big one. And now I'm spacing. I can't believe I'm going to forget the name, but there's one that... they have centers, almost like a dialysis center, where I'm spacing on the word, but a new medication, firefighters have it to kind of knock people out. There's a possible hallucinogenic factor to it, so it has to be closely monitored. But they are researching that, and that's really for people who are in a deep, dark place and having suicidal thoughts. Right. And it's not long term. I have, in addition to what you've mentioned about, you know, different aspects of marijuana and how it could be used, some people are even talking about like psilocybin mushrooms,
right?
Whether or not they can be used for depression and for dementia.
And they're having some interesting successes in small, little, tiny little groups.
Yeah,
absolutely. And I know that one of our I'm forgetting which state. I want to say Oregon. One of the representatives just put forth the bill to see if they could get these mushrooms legalized. And the way I look at it is, should everybody be high and all that all the time? That to me is a different conversation, but I want to make sure that the medical professionals have access to whatever they need to help me, to yeah. help all of us. And so if CBD, part of the cannabis plant, the hemp plant, the marijuana plant, or whatever you want to call it, if it's going to help us be healthier, this is a good thing. And our government, I know NIH highly recommends it, and recommends it also for other things. Like my daughter just recently had a bowel blockage surgery, and it's actually very helpful for people with IBS, with, gastro problems. Yep. So I think we need to make sure that our medical professionals have access to what they need, but I understand the dangers, and there's all this stuff that's always popping up and saying, "Oh, just take this and it'll cure depression." So there's a lot of scams at the same time.
Right.
And following the threads and figuring out whether or not it's real, because some of them look so real and they're like, "And this doctor approved it." People are in a really dark place, and they're supposed to be figuring out all this confusion when they're at a dark place. It seems really hard.
It's incredibly hard. And a couple things I have to say about that is, one, you mentioned some other resources, and I always talk about the fact that I think it's much more than just taking a medication. Yes. I think medication is something that should be considered, particularly if your depression is really severe. But medication should be considered, but don't frown upon these other strategies for improving your mental health. Not that it's going to be a quick fix, but I think it's an entire package. And I like to think of it as a multi-pronged approach for recovery. So there is the exercise piece. There is the eating better piece. There is the staying connected piece. And one term I love that I had heard, so I can't take credit for it, is the catch-22 of depression. Every single thing you need to do to work towards recovery is compromised by the very symptom itself.
Yes.
We're supposed to be exercising, but we have our energy is completely zapped. We're supposed to be healthy, but I couldn't eat at all. I had a gigantic knot in my stomach and I lost over 50 pounds. And others overeat because they can't stop eating. We're supposed to be connecting with people, but we're feeling so down and don't want to be around people. So it is a really, really challenging illness. But I do think, and then they talk about incidents of relapse. And I believe that those people who implement the multi-pronged approach of different resources that support them, you know, some I didn't mention was having a hobby, trying to stay attached to your hobby, journaling. There are just so many other pieces. But
music I've heard wonderful things about.
Absolutely, music. So I think those people who maybe take a medication, get better, and that's all they've done, yes, the rate of relapse may be high. Those people who have made significant changes in their lives, I think, and are mindful of the depression and doing meditation and mindfulness. I believe I didn't mention those two. You know, taking those pieces in, I think they have a much lower chance of a relapse. And that's just my personal, I don't have data to prove that, but that's my strong belief.
And I bet we have data as a society that would prove that, because it, you know, thinking that, at least, you know, and I can only speak from my own experience because I'm not an expert on this, but I find that rarely when I'm dealing with my depression gets worse in the winter time. I'm seasonal affective disorder. I find that light therapy has helped me. I find recently because my family has just gone through a rough year, you know, and by the way, so many other families are walking such a rough time, but it's been really a very difficult year, especially losing my mom, my husband, walking this path, which is so frightening. And then my daughter almost dying. So it's like, oh, wow. I'm so depressed. Oh, that's right. That's right. So I have tried different things. And recently I started trying, just listening to different sounds and frequencies that some people recommend. And part of me was almost paranoid. I thought, well, they're not, I'm a child of the 60s, I guess. So it's like, they're not putting subliminal messages in here that's going to make me worse, which is terrible. I'm not really a paranoid person. But at the same time, one day, it was actually after my daughter had had her emergency surgery. And we went through this for months, just months, where she was so sick. And I was okay walking it, but it was after she was going to be okay. I just sort of fell apart. And so I was trying different things, but just because I have to try to be healthy because my family needs me to be healthy. Mm. And we all have these pressures. And then I think of a man dealing with this. And we as society are still telling men, your job is to take care of the family at the expense of all else. And, you know, everybody else you should take care of. And of course we say that to women too, but I do feel a special empathy for men because, you know, you talk about first responders. When my mom was in trouble and I pick up the phone and I call 911 and it just happened to be three men came to our aid. And they were like angels to me coming. I'm like, oh, thank you. And then I get in the hospital situation and the men and the women, the professionals that are there, and they're giving us their everything. But they're doing that over and over and over and over and over again. This is just, my family was one and they were amazing. But, and as I started walking this path with my daughter, one of the administrators came by and met us at Henrico Doctors Hospital, which I'm a humongous fan of in the HCA system, because, you know, they saved my daughter's life. And she came by and she said, remember, you've got to take care of yourself. You can't awesome. Take care of somebody else. And I'm thinking, oh, it's going to be a couple of days. Yeah. Well, months later. And now she has months, almost 6 months of just recovering, and that's okay. But so the intensity of it all, Al, the intensity.
Well, I think what you describe is pretty common from what I've heard from others who are going through traumatic experiences, right? I think it's our adrenaline kicks in and we're in overdrive knowing I need to be strong, and our bodies make it work for us. And then once you find out, like you said, okay, my daughter's actually going to survive. And then you're able to kind of take a back seat, a tiny respite almost, and then all of a sudden you can crash yeah. hard. I know after 4 to 6 months or so of my wife taking care of our family, she like crashed with 3 days of strep throat and an eye infection and was knocked out on yeah. the couch. And I think her body had just kept her going for so long. And I asked her to go to therapy for herself because of what I knew I had put her through. And she went, you know, went to some talk therapy herself, which she really loved. So I wanted to make sure she was taking care of herself as well after taking care of me for so long. And it is so true. We have to take care of ourselves in order to take care of others. And one piece I'm trying to bring light to, and some people may know this if they follow me on Twitter, but I have a survey out for public school educators because yes. I see it in my own very district and in my own building. I mean, we are dealing with everybody knows about the mental health needs of our students and how we don't meet those needs and we need more. But nobody talks about the fact that we have educators who are dealing with kids who are going in and out of complex trauma on a daily basis, and there are consequences and implications to our own mental health. And we need to do a better job of taking care of the educators in our system. And
I agree.
Think we can do a much better job. And I think little by little, it's catching up to the national statistics, and we will see. And it's going to be sad if it's a knee-jerk reaction after many of the sad pieces we see to realize, whoa, we need to address this.
We're in trouble. We're in trouble.
Now.
So, Al, I'm going to ask you a really hard question. What
sure.
do we need to do in society? What do we need to do?
So that's a great question, and I don't have all the answers. I think it does start by talking about it. We need to be open about it. We need to talk about it. We need to share our stories. We need to have more top-level people talk about their experiences and share and be open about it. CEOs, leaders in our community, leaders of our organizations, talk about it, share their own stories, because many of them have them and they keep them behind closed doors. The more we do that, the more we get people who are open to sharing with us so that they can get the help they need. And we need to look at our policies, our legal stances, and we need to make sure there's a lot more accessible help for people. Our whole medical system needs to be looked at closely with our health insurances. You know, I hear so many people who are on a medication and then their health insurance changes and then they can't be on the same medication. So they
that was
on
working
any
for
medication.
Them.
Yeah.
That so, was working. And it's hard to find ones that work for you.
Absolutely. And I know our community mental health organizations are always talking about needing a higher level of reimbursements for the work they're doing from the government.
Right.
And
right.
we just, there needs to be more parity, right? What we see with the physical health, we need to see with the mental health.
And also, Al, I have a good friend of mine that is, he knows that he needs help, and he actually went out, and he has a lot of experience in the field, and he actually went out and started, looking for a therapist, and all of the therapists that he was even considering, they're all booked out months and months and months in advance. So, okay, I get to the point where I'm so desperate that I know I have to do something, and then I can't even find anybody.
Yeah. So if you are at a point of desperation, it's time to ask a friend or get yourself to the emergency room, to urgent care. Let them know about your situation, and then hopefully they can get you the help that you need. And it might be, mean some inpatient or some partial hospitalization. And it is well worth it if you are at a point of desperation and that point of need. And I think it's important to let those people know they need to reach out. They need to ask for help. And I like to tell people, if you're concerned about a loved one or a colleague or someone you care about, open up the door to a conversation. Yes. There's a myth, and it's not true. And I won't even say the myth because I don't want people to hear that. I just will say the truth is that if you ask someone about their mental health, and if you are concerned, if you're at a point where you are concerned that they may be considering and contemplating suicide, you need to ask. And you need to ask that directly. You are not going to put, I said I wouldn't say the myth, you're not going to put an idea in their head that they haven't thought about. What you are going to do is you're going to open up a door to a conversation that they may never have had or had the chance or opportunity to have. And you need to ask if they are so down and depressed that you're concerned. Of course, it's not the very first question, but eventually if you feel you need to, then you need to ask, are you thinking about suicide? Are you thinking about taking your own life? And you need to ask that, and then you need to take the proper steps. And I think most of those are pretty common sense. But if they say yes, you want to see it, like how serious? I mean, if it's a passive thought of, I wish I wasn't here, versus an active thought of, yes, I'm thinking of it, I have a plan, and I have the means, then you don't leave their side until you get them to the emergency room or you get them to a spouse or somebody else if you aren't that direct loved one. And you don't leave their side until you know they have help. And if it means driving them to the ER, then you drive them to the ER. Suicide is preventable. People need to hear that. I love the fact that our city, the city of St. Paul, has taken steps. We have something called the High Bridge. It's a known spot for people to jump from to take their own lives. And we now have, they had to do some renovations and repairs, and it included a nine foot suicide barrier. We need more of that as well, right? We need the government to know it's okay to spend that kind of money to save lives.
And these are our mental healths. These are our brains we're talking about here. It's just amazing. Once again, and I know we're out of time, so I'll just say, but watching my husband walk this path with dementia attacking his brain, he had a traumatic brain injury when he was a little boy. And so his brain is going to age differently than a brain that didn't, but it's what we're learning about our brains now, right now, is amazing, but there's still so much. And so saying that, that's why I want to make sure the audience knows how to listen to your show, how to find you on Twitter. Now, what we will do is when we post this episode on RueGlobal.com, we'll make sure that we put links so that you can go right there. But Al, tell our audience how they can follow your show, how they can follow your work on Twitter and other social media mediums if you're on there.
Yeah, absolutely. Great. Thank you for asking. So the best and easiest way is to go to thedepressionfiles.com. So if they go to thedepressionfiles.com, there are a bunch of buttons at the top of that page. One is my story. They can read my story if they're interested. But there's also a button that allows you to get to the blog. I have over 40 posts around the topic of depression, suicide prevention, and awareness. It's not only directed towards men. It's for everybody. And there is also a button link to my podcast. The podcast has the same name, The Depression Files. They can find that on iTunes and other media players. That would be the best way. You can find me on Twitter by going to Al Levin, as one word, Al Levin, A-L-L-E-V-I-N 18 is my Twitter handle. And there I often tweet links to my articles and such and different pieces all around this incredibly important topic.
I agree. It's very important. And that's one reason why your work caught my eye. I was very impressed. And also, Al takes the time to really engage on Twitter and answer questions and, you know, follow people and make comments. So if you know of anybody that's struggling, one place you can go right away is to the Depression Files. Go to depressionfiles.com. There's a lot of resources out there and you can find out how to follow Al. I mean, we're going to keep giving you the resources you need. And I think we all have to just be mindful and loving and caring of each other during these intense times to help make sure that everybody's okay. But Al, thank you for your work. I am so grateful.
Yeah. Well, thank you for this opportunity. Thank you. I know, Deborah, you've been helping me out and retweeting my work. So I really appreciate your support and the opportunity to be on your show. And I wish you luck. You are going through some challenging times.
I really am.
I'm really glad, though, that you're a person who clearly knows how to take care of yourself. You just need to make sure you're actually doing the work you know is important to take care of yourself so that you can support your family. And
You're right.
Sounds like you're doing a fantastic job of it.
Yeah, thank you so much, Al. I appreciate that. I'm definitely using my resources. So, and also, like you said, I think it really helps to talk about it. So I'm talking about it a lot as we're all walking it, but I think we all have to be kind and gentle to each other, you know,
absolutely.
Right now. So,
absolutely.
So happy holidays, Al, and to all my viewers. And we will talk to everybody again. Thank you, everyone.